Okay, so today is Tuesday, October 8th. We're going to be finishing up articulations. We're going to work on a little bit of muscular tissue information today. So we're kind of heading now into different territory. We're actually going into more of a physiological territory than we've been in the past, and that may change the way you study for this upcoming test number 3. Because our content is physiology, I would encourage you to not do flashcards for this material, but instead talk to somebody. I know that you probably have somebody in this classroom or maybe somebody at home that will listen to you explain the content. If no one will listen to you, then I would get in the shower or wherever and just talk it out loud. Get in the car, talk it through. If you cannot explain how muscle contraction works or how nerve impulse transmission works, then come see me. Let's talk together until you can get it done without having to read it in the course pack. I'm going to repeat it over the course of multiple days. So if you work through it with me, maybe listen to this recording and talk through it with me, then I think we'll get you to a point where you're mostly comfortable with this content. Before we get to muscles, though, let me wrap up the last of articulations. We were working on that before our test last Tuesday. We actually had completed through page 73. I wanted to ask you before I keep moving, is there anything that you need to review on page 72 or 73? Anything you need to review? Okay. Why don't we go through the words on page 74? These are movements in a synovial or diarthritic joint. This gives us a great opportunity to review. What kind of movement do you get in a diarthrosis? Freedom of movement, right. So a free range of motion, like you would expect in your arms and legs, is found in a diarthrosis joint. The word synovial describes how that joint is made. What does that imply is found inside the joint? Synovial fluid, good. And what does that fluid do for the joint's movement? Lubricates, good. So we expect to see in these freely movable joints, fluids inside that help to lubricate and reduce friction in those joints. That is what's on this page, page 74. These are synovial by structural classification. They're diarthroses by functional classification. So I don't have that word on that page, but this whole page deals with those diarthroses or freely movable joints. I put a bracket around numbers 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6. 7 and 8 are not bracketed, but 9 and 10, 11 and 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 are bracketed because they are antagonistic actions. Meaning what? They're opposite. Good. So when you're learning the muscle actions, which will be your next test in lab, think about this. If you have a muscle flexor on the anterior side of the body, the extensor is on the posterior side. They're on opposite sides of your body. For instance, triceps brachii and biceps brachii, well, of course, triceps is back here, biceps is here. Biceps is a flexor, makes the arm bend. Triceps is on the opposite side. It's an extensor, makes the arm straighten. So just think about that if you get stuck learning those muscles and their actions. The extensors and flexors tend to be on opposite sides of the body. Not always anterior, posterior. It may in fact be reversed depending on the muscles. So let's hit anterior, or let's rather hit flexion and extension first. To flex a joint is to bend a joint. And in fancy language, if you're flexing a joint, you're bringing bones closer together. So if you bend your arm at the elbow, you're flexing at the elbow. You can flex at the hip, you can flex at the knee, you can even flex at the ankle. And when I use the word flex, all I mean is bend. So I'm bending that joint. In other words, I'm bringing bones closer together by flexing or bending that joint. So what is to extend? straighten, right? So if I want to straighten my arm at the elbow joint, then I have to use an extensor muscle. That happens to be triceps brachii. So flexors bend, whereas extensors straighten a joint. Likewise in your legs, if you're standing up straight, then you're extending at the hip, you're extending at the knee, because those joints are actually straightened out. Let's talk about plantar flexion and dorsiflexion. You may want to make a note, these only occur at the foot. Plantar flexion and dorsiflexion, that's numbers 3 and 4. These only occur at the foot. Let me give you a helpful hint. Dorsi, that word means where? Back. Okay, so if I lift my toes up off the floor and pull them toward the back, I'm doing dorsiflexion. So if you're driving a car and you lift your foot up off the pedal, you're doing dorsiflexion. When you walk and your foot lifts up off the ground, you're doing dorsiflexion. What is plantar flexion? Pointing your toes, right? So if you're pushing or planting your foot, planting your toes toward the ground, you're performing plantar flexion. So if you stand on your tippy toes, if you're just simply walking, if you're stepping on a gas pedal and pushing your toes down, you're performing plantar flexion. So I think of dorsi as being toward the back, lifting the toes off the floor, versus plantar flexion, which I literally think about planting my toes toward the ground. Plantar flexion is going to push my toes down, just like if you were standing on tiptoes. So interesting side note here, people who fall and trip over their own feet, I'm one of those, and you know, sprain your ankle, you do it by plantar flexion. Most of the time you plantar flex, push your foot down and trip over your own feet. And if you ever injure your feet or your ankles by doing this and, you know, have a sprained ankle, you better watch it, because the next time around, you're out walking again, you may re-injure that because your proprioceptors are off. So unfortunately, plantar flexion is the way that most of us trip ourselves up and get injured. All right, the next two there, abduction and adduction, have to do with moving body parts away from the midline or toward the midline. Ab, A-B, moves your body parts in what direction? Away. So if you ever did jumping jacks in PE in school, as your arms and legs move away from your midline, you're performing A-B, abduction. As you add your arms or legs back to the midline, you're performing adduction, A-D. I'll tell you a helpful hint here. If somebody's going to abduct me, I'm going to move my arms away, right? Get away. So abduct is move away. Adding, of course, means returning those body parts to the midline. You can also abduct and adduct your fingers. I mean, this is crazy, right? So abduction moves your fingers out. Adduction moves them back together. You can abduct your leg. You can abduct your arm. Sorry, ab, I'm going away. Adding them back brings them towards your midline. So, you know, you've got other body parts besides the arms that you can do this action with. Can you circumduct your arm for me? Airplanes, right? Little kids say I'm an airplane and they take their arms and you're doing the exact right motion. It's actually a combination of ab and adduction, flexion and extension. It has no antagonistic option. It's by itself. Okay, so little kids doing airplanes is a great example of circumduction. Rotation is also a singular action. It has no antagonistic or opposite action. And if you rotate your neck at atlas and axis, then you can perform rotation. So by shaking your head no, swiveling left and right, you're performing rotation. Great example, because of dens, or that odontoid process that sits up there, allows your head to rotate and swivel left and right. You can also rotate your arms along the longitudinal axis, little harder to rotate your legs, but you can do that as well. So it has no opposite action. Shaking your head no is probably one of our best examples. Let's talk about supination and pronation. These are numbers 9 and 10. They occur only at the wrist or hand. That may be a note you want to add. Pronation and supination, numbers 9 and 10, occur only at the hand or wrist. It's Halloween month, so if you're looking out for zombies, you're looking out for them walking in a prone position. If your hands are posterior with the palms facing down, then you're in what's called a prone position. So you can't see my palms. P for P. Palms are posterior in a prone position. How should I place my hands if they're in a supine position?
Palms up.
So if I'm coming to you carrying a bowl of soup, soup and supination sound a lot alike. So the palms are superior. Think about carrying a bowl of soup for supination. Okay, so keep the P's and S's straight there. Palms are posterior in pronation. Palms are superior in supination. Carry that bowl of soup. All right, numbers 11 and 12 are back to the foot ankle area only. Numbers 11 and 12 are the foot or ankle area only. Worst thing ever is to walk through a parking lot, step on chewing gum. If you look at the bottom of your shoe, by bending your ankle and your foot toward the midline, you're inverting your foot. Okay, so if you turn your foot toward the midline, inversion. If you turn your foot outward, toward the lateral side of your body, then you're everting your foot, or eversion. So I think about stepping on chewing gum. Turning toward the midline is inversion. Turning it out laterally is eversion. These last few are pretty easy to remember. If you elevate a body part, what are you doing to it? Lifting it up. So if you lift your shoulders, you're elevating them. If you put them back down, you're depressing them. Opposite actions. You can also elevate your mandible and depress it. What are you doing if you elevate your mandible? Closing your mouth. And if you depress it, you're gaping. So you can lift or lower a body part. Those are just elevations and depressions, opposite terms to each other. And the last two terms there, pro and retraction, typically have to do with areas of the body that you can move anteriorly or posteriorly. It's hard to do with many body parts, but one you can do it with is the jaw. So if you jut your jaw forward, you're having a underbite, I guess you would say. You've got protraction, you're pushing your jaw forward. If you pull your jaw back, then you're retracting it. Okay, so that's probably one of the better examples we have of a body part moving anterior versus posterior. Do you need to hear any of these again?
So protraction is moving something out?
Moving it forward horizontally. Like, think about pushing your jaw forward.
Turtleneck.
Interior. What's that?
Turtleneck.
Turtleneck, and that would do it too, yeah. Turtleneck, put your neck out.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Pull it back would be retracting it. The hokey pokey might, in fact, be pro and retraction. Stick your left foot out, stick your left foot in. We could probably argue that it's more than one of these on this list. What you have on the next test are maybe a definition or two, maybe a picture or two, and I've got you a set of practice pictures on page 75. There are answers down at the very bottom. So as you're going through those and reviewing them for that next test, keep in mind that sometimes they look like they may be more than one. So I will try to avoid giving you a picture that has multiple answers. It possibly could be that particular drawing. Do y'all have any questions about this articulation material? Now that is a chapter for flashcards, right? So if you're a flashcards kind of person, that is your chapter. The next one though, not so much. Lay the foundation with skeletal muscle tissue. That's going to be the primary focus of this chapter. This is chapter 10, by the way, in your textbook. And we're going to get a little bit into some anatomy there. Get a little bit into the physiology before we call it a day. I'm going to start you out on page 76. At the very top of your page, there are four major jobs of muscle tissue. And to be specific, we're talking about skeletal muscle tissue. All right, so obviously muscle tissue is the first thing there, providing movement. So is this movement voluntary or involuntary? Voluntary, good. What does that mean? You can control it, good. Does skeletal muscle have any involuntary movements? Shivering, good. Good. So mostly it's skeletal muscle in the voluntary mode, but you're right, we can shiver to produce heat. Actually, our fourth issue here. Maintaining posture is another important feature of our skeletal muscle tissue. You may have been told at some point in your life to sit up straight and put your shoulders back. And I don't know how many of y'all did that just now, right? Like four of you just sat up straighter. Maybe somebody in your life has sat around a table and said, okay, sit up straight, don't slouch. Posture is actually dependent upon good, strong muscle tissue. Last class period or two, I talked about bones being weak in outer space. Muscles are weak in outer space too. So back in the 70s, when people were spending more and more time in outer space, they didn't understand, you know, fully how to make those muscles stronger. Nowadays, if you ever happen to see somebody in outer space on a news feed, they're doing some kind of exercise that produces muscle strength. So if you don't do that and you spend a year in outer space, you're going to come home and be so weak that you can't even support your body's weight. So they want to make sure that when people come home, they've maintained their muscle strength and their posture. So how do muscles help to stabilize joints? What do they need to help them stabilize joints? Exercise is one thing. What helps to bind muscles to bones? Tendons, yeah, and ligaments, of course, bind bone to bone. So we need muscles and tendons and ligaments to stabilize and produce strong, healthy joints. The last one there is one that people often forget about. Skeletal muscle tissue is actually important for maintaining your body temperature because every time you move a muscle, you generate heat. It's a byproduct of using ATP to move those muscles. And you're right, you can also shiver to produce heat. That's an involuntary function of our skeletal muscle tissue. All right, so let's talk about major functions there of muscle tissue in terms of characteristics. The first term is excitability. So what that means is muscle tissue, especially skeletal muscle tissue, must be excitable. If it's excitable, what can it respond to? A stimulus, right. Where does the stimulus come from? Nerves. Where does the ultimate decision for your movement come from? Brain, right? So if you decide to move your arm, your brain tells a nerve that tells your muscles in your arm to become excited. And so that's the first step toward muscle contraction. Excitement has to happen in order for a muscle contraction to occur. What if your brain says, I want to move my arm, and the message is sent to a nerve, and the muscle doesn't respond? What's wrong with that muscle?
not enough blood?
It could be not enough blood.
Nerves are severed.
Maybe nerves are severed. And you would say that that muscle is not excitable, right? So if you sit on your foot and your foot goes to sleep and you get up and you have that awful pins and needles tingling feeling, you've cut off your blood supply. And so if you don't have a nerve supply or blood supply, then those muscles can't be excitable. So you can't walk if your foot's asleep, right? Okay, so paralysis, tingling nerves, you know, other diseases may cause this kind of condition where muscles can't communicate with nerves. So once you tell a muscle that you want it to contract, then its job is to shorten that muscle to produce a contraction. So contractility is related to muscle shortening. And that's actually what we're going to talk about today. Excitability followed by contraction. One last feature, this is especially important for muscle tissues, is elasticity. So if you wear underwear, you may have some underwear that probably needs to be tossed, right? Just hang on for dear life. I can get one more wear out of this, right? Okay, so what probably prompts you, besides holy underwear, to throw it in the garbage? Stains. We're going to avoid the stains conversation. I'm going to focus on Tiffany's, right? The elasticity is gone. We have all sorts of underwear issues, right? So the elasticity is what muscle tissue is. If it's lost its elasticity, what does that mean?
It's not going to stay up.
It's not going to stay up. No point in wearing it if it doesn't stay up, right? Okay, so muscle tissue that's lost its elasticity has lost its snapback. So if you've got a rubber band or elastic underwear, when you've got that stretch that doesn't recoil back, you've lost the elasticity. So that's really what's important about exercise and muscle tissue. If you exercise, your smooth, your skeletal, especially your skeletal and your heart muscle tissue, all have a good elastic value. They stretch, but most importantly, they pop back to their original size. So what do people die of? Heart muscle tissue that's lost its elasticity. Okay, so elasticity is certainly an important feature here for this muscle tissue. Just to review, three pictures there in the middle of your page. Can you tell me which one is the first one?
Cardiac.
Cardiac, good. How did you know? Strided. Any other features? Intercalated discs, good. Any other features?
Branches,
good. All right, so that first picture is in fact cardiac muscle tissue. It is branched, it is striated, there are intercalated discs there, and this is found only in the what?
Heart
muscle, good. Middle picture, what is that one? Smooth muscle, good. How did you know?
Not striated.
Not striated, right. Good. So it looks kind of like other tissues. There's no apical surface, though. No basement membrane. This particular muscle tissue is found in the walls of what? Digestive system, hollow organs, good. Vessels have smooth muscle tissue. It contracts in what method? Peristalsis, good. And so this is a long-term contraction. It is a type of contraction, kind of like squeezing a tube of toothpaste. There are rhythmic contractions that occur in your digestive system and in your vessels. This helps to milk along the substance on the inside. So it's all involuntary. It's a squeezing and a relaxing. Squeeze and a relax that occurs in those muscle tissues. So we'll talk a lot about peristalsis in Bio 211. It's a great process to help involuntarily move substances through hollow organ tubes. Well, obviously the last picture is skeletal muscle tissue. How would you know this one? Striations. Mini nuclei. Good. Any branching here? No branching. Good. Any intercalated discs? Yeah, no discs here. And where is this muscle tissue found? Skeleton, good. So it moves our bones. It's attached to our bones by way of what? tendons, good. So tendons directly anchor a muscle to a bone. Ligaments stabilize joints because they anchor bone to bone. Okay, so we're going to talk mostly in this chapter about skeletal muscle tissue. So that was just a good review for us, middle of the page there. Do y'all have any questions on 76? All right, so what we're going to do now is talk about this picture on page 77. Thought about raising the screen, but maybe I won't. If it goes up, it may not come back down either. Okay, so we're going to label this picture together. I'm going to start you off with the blank at the very top of your page. Muscle tissue is arranged with membranes or connective tissue wrapping it into bundles. The term at the very top, number one, is this word here, epimysium. Epimysium is number one at the top. And it is this covering here on the outside of the muscle. Okay, epimysium number one is this covering out here on the outside of the muscle. So back to eating again. If you've ever looked at a raw chicken breast or even a roast, whether it's pork or beef, you may notice a shiny membrane on the outside surface of that meat. Chicken breast is great for it. You may notice if you peel the skin back, there's a shiny covering on the top of that skin, or actually on the bottom of that skin that adheres to the muscle, which is the chicken breast tissue. That is likely the epimysium, this outer portion. It's made up of fascia. It helps to cover and wrap the outside of that muscle tissue. All right, so if you come in and look inside the muscle, you're going to find that there are muscle cells wrapped in bundles. And you'll notice, like, here's a bundle, and there's cells on the inside. Here's a bundle. There's multiple sets of bundles. Each of these is wrapped by a membrane, and the membrane is called the perimysium. That's number two's blank.
So there's the line around the cells?
It is the line. That's right. Okay, so perimysium is the line here that goes around these cells. Number three is the last term up here. It's endomysium. Number three's term is endomysium. And in this picture, I've just shaded around one muscle cell. You may want to draw a little sleeve on that muscle cell and label that as your endomysium. So this is a muscle cell sticking out. You may just want to shade a sleeve around that muscle cell.
So is the whole thing sticking out?
Yeah, that thing sticking out your muscle cell, just draw a sleeve around it and then shade it. That's going to be your endomysium. If you happen to look at, say, pork roast or beef roast, those are especially easy to see the muscle fibers in their groups or bundles called fascicles. And you may sometimes see a membrane that's cooked in there as well. You may not eat the membrane. You may pull it aside and think it's something that you know, maybe don't want to eat. But those are the membranes that wrap around each of these bundles of muscle cells. So let's build this backwards from 3 to 2 to 1. Let's go in reverse. The muscle cell has a wrapping. The wrapping is called an endomysium. Bundles of muscle cells are grouped together. Those bundles are called fascicles. And what wraps a fascicle? Perimysium. And then all of these bundles of muscle cells are put together in a group, and outside they're wrapped by what? Epimysium. Good. So keep your prefixes straight. epi outside, peri around, endo is inside or within. Fascicle, right. And number four, there's a couple of terms to point out. We've talked about tendons before. Tendons are the connections between muscles and a bone. So, for instance, the Achilles tendon here is a great visual for seeing how the collagen fibers taper out of that muscle and connect it to that bone. If you happen to injure a tendon, you're then interrupting the connection between the muscle and the bone it's attached to. In fact, if someone were to cut that Achilles tendon, the gastrocnemius muscle would fly up the back of the leg like a window shade. So it would have to be surgically reattached in order to be anchored back down to the calcaneus or that heel bone. Back in the day, you know, before modern surgery, if somebody injured that, their leg was just limp at the foot. There was no way that person could walk with a severed Achilles tendon. An aponeurosis is kind of the same thing as a tendon, but instead of anchoring muscle to bone, an aponeurosis anchors muscle to muscle. And one really awesome example of that is on your skull. Some people say that frontalis and occipitalis are actually part of the same muscle, and they call it fronto-occipitalis to, you know, demonstrate that. And the piece of connective tissue that anchors them together is that aponeurosis. It's got a fancy name there, Galea aponeurotica. So a tendon anchors a muscle to a bone, and aponeurosis anchors a muscle to a muscle. Okay, both are connective tissue anchorings. Okay, so I know that these words are confusing, so let's do a quick demo. I've got paper plates, straws, apparently I've rated Wendy's, and napkins. All right, so we're going to take a look. If each drinking straw is an individual muscle cell, each one is wrapped by its own endomycium. So the paper on the drinking straw is going to be my endomycium. Pull back the paper, there's my muscle cell underneath. Okay, so I've got all these muscle cells. You can see they're endomycium. Wendy's was a good choice because you can see the paper wrapping, right? All right, so that wrapping on the outside is the endomycium around a muscle cell inside. So if I put a bundle together, what is a bundle called?
A
fascicle. And what should I wrap a fascicle with?
Perimycium.
Good. So here we have a simple napkin that's going to serve as our perimycium. There's my bundle of muscle cells. I'm just going to wrap them up. And now I've got my perimycium that covers around that fascicle. I should have a perimycium here. I've got another bundle, another set of cells here, another set of muscle cells that form a fascicle wrapped by perimycium. Now I've got all these together and I want to wrap them on the outside with what?
Epi,
that's right. So take your paper plate, wrap on the outside, and of course, now you've got this whole set of muscle cells bundled together. That's your epimycium on the outside. And then when you look inside, you kind of got the sense for the picture we were looking at earlier. You kind of can see those muscle cells sticking out. Okay, so epi, peri wraps a fascicle, and what wraps a muscle cell? Endo. Good. Okay, so that takes us to the next term near the bottom of your page. Okay, number one near the bottom of your page is for this word here, sarcolemma. And the sarcolemma is just a fancy word for the plasma membrane. So if you know that the plasma membrane is the outer covering of a cell, now when we talk about muscles, little bell wants to go off and say, oh yeah, here it's got a fancy name. The plasma membrane is just called the sarcolemma. And the next blank there The cytoplasm is called the sarcoplasm. The cytoplasm is called the sarcoplasm. So likewise, if you think about the cytoplasm of a muscle cell, the fancy word for it being specifically in a muscle cell is sarcoplasm. Like, we don't have enough to remember, right? Now to give you a separate vocabulary. It would actually be inside your muscle cell, which is so very tiny, it's hard to see. So it would be the white spaces inside the muscle cell. And that membrane there would actually be your sarcolemma, which is inside your endomycium. Okay. So just to kind of give you an idea to how this works, if my actual sleeve was my endomycium, I pull it back and you can see my arm, and that's my muscle cell. What you're looking at is the sarcolemma. That is our cell's membrane or plasma membrane. And if you were to look inside the muscle cell, inside here, you would see some semi-fluid medium. We normally call it cytoplasm, but here we call it sarcoplasm. Okay, so we're just giving special names because we're dealing with muscle tissue. I'll talk to you about T-tubules in just a moment. Let me go ahead and give you the number 2 blank at the very bottom. That blank is for myofibril. Number 2 blank at the very bottom is myofibril. You know, way back when we talked about organelles, you know, you probably had mitochondria, lysosomes, rough ER, all that good stuff. We did not cover this organelle. This organelle, the myofibril, is actually a very tiny little organelle inside your muscle cells, and its job is to shorten and produce muscle contraction. When we talk about muscle contraction, we're going to talk about it building from the myofibril up. So we're looking at the size of an organelle. That's how our scale of muscle contraction works. Just a helpful hint here, what is myo as a prefix?
Muscle.
And how about sarco? Like sarcolemma, sarcoplasmic reticulum, sarco flesh. Yeah, so it technically refers to the flesh or the muscle tissue. At the very bottom of page 77, let me introduce you to the T-tubules. They are sometimes called T-tubules instead of transverse tubules. Okay, so let's translate this picture. First thing up here is the word sarcolemma. What does sarcolemma mean? Plasma membrane, good. So the sarcolemma is just a fancy word for plasma membrane. Uh-oh, something got touched. Doesn't want to go forward, does it? Okay. I'll tell you what. Let's draw a sarcolemma with its T-tubules. I'll put that on the board for you. We'll just turn this off because we're heading in that direction anyway. Okay. So let me start you back with this picture. We are talking about muscle cells, we're talking about myofibrils, so we're on that level of detail here. Let me pull a muscle cell down here so that you can see it bigger. We know that muscle cells have striations, right? Okay, we'll deal with that in just a moment. We're talking about T-tubules, and these T-tubules are actually little, they're tubes, and they make a dive deep into the muscle tissue. So because they make something that looks like a T shape, we call them transversor T-tubules. Now, why they're important is because they allow for nerve impulses to reach deep into your muscle tissue. If you zap this muscle and you want it to become excited, you don't want it to occur in a wave across this muscle tissue. What do you want this muscle to do all at once? Contract. Okay. So the way you get this muscle tissue to work in unison all at once is you have these T-tubules go deep into these muscles that carries the message to contract deep into all your muscle cells at once. So that's what we want to see happening is T-tubules exciting muscle tissue simultaneously. On that worksheet at the very bottom, there's a term down there I do want to introduce to you as well. If you read along, it says it connects, those T-tubules connect you to the S arm. Okay, do you see that term? It says those T-tubules connect us to the S arm. Okay, we're going to talk more about the SR in a little bit, but that's actually a storage device for calcium. It's like the endoplasmic reticulum of a muscle cell. Okay, SR. We'll come back and talk about that. Where I'd like to take you is over to page 79. Closer to the humerus, I have to shorten biceps brachii. That's what's pulling those bones closer together. That shortening process actually begins here with this muscle cell and its myofibrils. We're going to look at the details of where this striation or banding pattern comes from, because the story of muscle contraction is told in those bands or those light dark areas of that muscle cell. So I'm going to help you label the picture that's on page 79. Picture. What you're looking at is the detail of a myofibril. We're talking about, itty bitty organelle sized structures inside your muscle cells. The easiest thing to spot here is a zigzag shaped line. What is the name of that line? Z line. Good. I'm going to label that first. Some books call it a disc, line, disc, whatever. It's zigzag or Z-shaped. That's the important thing to notice about it. That's what makes it really easy to recognize. So we know that muscle tissue is composed of proteins. Proteins are a big part of muscle tissue. There are two main kinds of proteins that are found here. One is called a thin filament, the other is called a thick filament. That's just nicknames for what they're actually made of. These thin filaments that are anchored to our Z lines, they're actually made up of a protein called what?
Actin.
Actin. Good. All right, so let me repeat where we're at. We're talking about myofibril structure. Myofibrils are the teeny tiny little organelles found inside your muscle cells. Because they have this striped pattern to them, muscle cells have a striation pattern as well. So we first identify a membrane called a Z-line, looks like a zigzag, and to it is anchored a thin filament. The thin filament is actually a type of protein called an actin filament. So every side here, we've got thin filaments anchored to that Z-line. Are you so far so good? Okay. Before I draw in the thick filaments, let's also identify something called a sarcomere. There's that prefix again, right? Sarco means what?
Flesh.
Good. And if I'm looking for a sarcomere, I'm looking for a repeating unit. It goes from one what to the next what?
Z-line to Z-line.
Z-line to Z-line. Good. So I'm just going to bracket that off. And that unit's called my sarcomere. So we know that muscles contract. That's how they shorten and pull bones. That's something we have to keep in mind, because if muscles contract and shorten, guess what happens to the sarcomere when muscles contract? It shortens, yeah. So that's going to be part of our job, is to figure out how we make this muscle shorten, how that sarcomere shortens. Okay, one more component here. There are two types of proteins in a typical myofibril. We're going to focus on the two biggies. They are actin and myosin. Myosin makes up this thick protein here. It's called a thick filament. And one very easy way to spot it, it has what?
Myosin
heads. Yeah, those little bumps are called myosin heads. Have you ever been really bored and looked at Velcro up close? Okay, so if you need something to entertain your mind, I would recommend Velcro. Get a magnifying glass and look at it up close. It's really cool to look at. And I believe, if I remember correctly, it was invented for outer space because they needed something to stick together, but they couldn't use traditional methods. So voila, Velcro. Look at it up close because it's a loop and a hook. And that's how the pieces stick together. So that's how the myosin heads actually work. They don't attach to a loop like with Velcro, but they're a hook kind of, you know, in a way. And when we do muscle contraction, they hook onto one of these thin filaments. We say they bind to those thin filaments. So that's kind of what we want to think of, is like those myosin heads reaching up and hooking on like they would with Velcro to those thin filaments. All right, just a couple more things on this picture, an A band and an I band. A bands are dark bands. They include the thick filaments. I'm going to just draw a dotted line around the ends of my thick filaments. And I'm going to make this area between those dotted lines my A band or dark band. If I want to circle an I band, what should I include? Yikes. If I want to circle the I band, I should include?
Z-lines, good.
Okay, so Z-lines, little bit of the thin filament includes in an I-band. What should not be found in an I-band?
Thick filaments.
All right, so make sure not to catch any thick filaments in there. So I actually have an I-band around my Z-line, catch some of those thin filaments, just don't catch the thick ones in there. A-bands have, of course, thick filaments. I could actually draw another I-band over here. And right there you have your striation pattern, light, dark, light dark banding patterns come from I bands, which are light, A bands, which are dark, I bands, A bands, and so forth. So, in fact, the striations that we see on muscle tissue comes from these myofibrils and this banding pattern, the way it's set up with those thin and thick filaments. All right, so inside of our A band, let me point out that there's a very special area there that has no thin filaments. Thin filament ends here. Here, here, then filament ends over here. And if I look right in the middle, I can get an area of my thick filament where there's absolutely no thin filaments, right? Okay, what should we call that zone?
H zone.
Good, so I'm just gonna draw a heavy line right down through the middle here. Okay, that H zone is right there in the center. All right, no thin filaments, just thick filaments in that middle area. Hey, if you flip the page, page 80 has an already completed drawing for you. Okay, so if you need to double check and make sure you got everything lined up okay. By the way, over on page 81, I've given you some details about most of what we've discussed today. We haven't done everything, but that's where I'd like to start you in class on Thursday, is on page 80, 81. Go back over this one more time, make sure you're comfortable, and then we're going to talk through excitation, contraction, coupling. I would really encourage you to read this in chapter 10 of your book. It may take reading it 5 times to where it starts to click and make some sense. But what I'll do is I'll be going over excitation, contraction, coupling in here. We'll do it again the next week. I'll do it as many times as you need to make sure that you feel comfortable with it. Okay? So we'll start with 80, 81 in class on Thursday.